From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. A few months ago, an editor at Entrepreneur forwarded me this piece that had been submitted to her. It was called Before You Rebuild, Ask This One Question. And it was written by Matt Higgins, who is a recurring shark on Shark Tank. He's also co-founder and CEO of a private investment firm called RSE Ventures and an executive fellow at Harvard Business School. And he was making this point in this piece. I'm just gonna read you the very beginning of it. It starts like this. He says, "How can I rebuild my business as fast as possible? It's the one question all entrepreneurs and CEOs are considering right now, and it's the wrong one. Instead, we should all be asking, if I were starting my business today from scratch, what business would I build?" And then he goes on to make this case, this very compelling case for moving forward. For not thinking about trying to rebuild what is gone, but instead to build for now. And he writes, "Rebuilding that business, that old business, is like rebuilding a relic. It's time to let go and create something new." And then Matt offers basically a blueprint for doing that. It's a three-step process. He says, first, you should give yourself permission to challenge every assumption. And then after that, you should write down how your business has evolved since you launched at the very beginning. Track the changes that maybe you hadn't thought about as changes so you understand exactly where you've gone. And then number three, remember how you really felt before the crisis. Because of course, we have this tendency with everything to romanticize what happened before. Even though there were challenges, once there are new challenges, we look back at the old challenges and we go, oh, I remember those challenges. That was such a good time, right? But no. What actually was going on? Think about it. Is that what you want to return to, really? Or do you want to build something better? So anyway, we published that essay in the July-August issue of the magazine, and then by pure coincidence, one having nothing to do with the other, I get an email from this guy I know named Eric who runs an event called PodMax. It's this event for podcasters, and I'd actually keynoted it before in person a year ago maybe or something like that, but now he's, of course, like everybody, doing this event digitally, and he asked me if I would, as the keynote, interview Matt Higgins. And so I see this and I think, oh, Matt Higgins, that guy who just wrote that really great piece. We can have a fantastic conversation about how to embrace change, how to look forward, and how to shed these old visions of ourselves and old understandings of what our business is. So I said, sure. And then not long after, Matt Higgins and I were chatting for an audience.
The one thing I found fascinating about this crisis, we never have had a greater opportunity to crowdsource solutions to the same exact problems that everyone, all 7 billion people on planet Earth are dealing with. And yet we can't quite cross over to a place of humility and open-mindedness that we're taking advantage of those ideas.
That, of course, is Matt Higgins. That's from the very beginning of our conversation. I had opened by reading some of his own column back to him, because if it has not ever happened to you, I assure you, one of the greatest pleasures in life is being quoted back to oneself. And I wanted him to elaborate on why he was sharing that message and why he felt it was so important for entrepreneurs to be looking forward instead of backwards.
Well, let's say we have 20 portfolios at RSE Ventures where we own a significant stake. And I was dealing with CEOs day and night through really tough emotional issues. We have a lot of brick and mortar locations. And what I found was, you know, when your back is up against the wall and your baby is really under attack in every different kind of way, right? That your first reflex is to get back on your feet as soon as possible. It's the Independence Day of the pandemic, right? We will rebuild better than ever before. And that feels comfortable, right? It's defiant, it's taking matters into your own hands. And what I kept saying in these conversations with our CEOs, like, what if you rush to rebuild what is effectively a carbon copy of a bygone era by the time we come out the other side of this, right? Like, don't miss this opportunity to ask yourself key fundamental questions. And first of all, the most important one, right? If I were building my business today, what business would I build? So I think it begins with giving yourself permission to look anew at all your old assumptions. And the reason why that's important is COVID has truly upended everything going forward, right? So we started with all of our CEOs going through this self-auditing process and asking a series of sub-questions once you ask the fundamental one, which is number one, how has my business evolved in the last several years from the time I first put out that pitch deck, right? The business looks nothing like the pitch deck. And maybe there were certain elements of my business that actually weren't working well, but I was afraid to confront them. I didn't have the time to confront them. I didn't have the emotional bandwidth to confront. Well, now I have no choice but to confront them. But also maybe what I was treating as the side hustle or the sideshow should have been the main event. And now that my business is potentially in ruins, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't take a hard look. And what I found is, as I started having that conversation with each CEO, it was like a weight had gone off their shoulders. Like, wait, yeah, we don't need to rebuild this. Like, we don't necessarily need to open all those stores again. Maybe there's another way. So I personally believe very strongly philosophically that we spend way too much time searching for answers than asking ourselves, are we asking the right question? And as long as you're asking the right question, you'll eventually find your way to a good place. But if you never audit that question, you could end up in completely the wrong direction. So it's a very philosophical way to begin, but that's a lot of what we've been going through, you know, at RSC.
It's such an important conversation to have. And I love that image of weight being lifted off of people's shoulders as they see that there's a different way forward, that they don't have to try to put pieces back together. They can actually just build for now. So here's what I want to do on this episode of Problem Solvers. I'm going to play for you the conversation that I had with Matt Higgins. We begin by going deeper into this subject of how an entrepreneur can build for right now. But then we go really deep. We get into how to create change within ourselves, how to use crisis to find perspective, how to make sense of the worst things that have happened to us, and how to be vulnerable in a way that actually builds up other people. It was a really great, powerful conversation. I loved having it, and I think that you'll really enjoy hearing it. So, my conversation with Matt Higgins coming up after the break. In these unpredictable times, every hire you make feels critical. So how do you find the right person? You go to Indeed. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring, which means you only pay for what you need. You can pause your account at any time and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed has powerful tools to make your search that much easier. Like, for example, sponsored jobs, which are shown to be 3.5 more times likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the important hire that you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. And bonus for you, Indeed is offering Problem Solvers listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more qualified candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/PSP. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/PSP. That's PSP for Problem Solvers Podcast. Indeed.com/PSP. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through September 30th. All right, we're back. So now it's time to get into my conversation with Matt Higgins. And before the break, you heard him talk about how he has been walking his entrepreneurs that he invests in through this process of rethinking their business and focusing on the opportunity for now. And so when he said that, I asked him, can he give me a specific example of how that's gone so we can see it play out? And here's what he said.
Yeah, sure. So we have a lot of brick and mortar in our portfolio, especially in the food area, which has been decimated in different ways. If you're fast casual, that means one thing. If you're fine dining, that means another. But regardless, if you happen to own a retail footprint, you're in trouble in some way or another. And a lot of the businesses that we have really strong brands. And we're just starting to see significant traction with consumer products, but also with e-com. And in the early days of COVID, when you don't know when this might come to an end, we took a step back, said, look, the obvious thing to do here, or what might seem obvious, let's cut spending. We need to extend our runway as long as possible, reduce the burn, which is generally true. Survival was the name of the game in phase one. But in kind of phase two, post-survival, is saying, actually, though, if we know that e-com behavior is going to change potentially permanently, and that all those people who are reluctant to buy online, I don't know who they were, but apparently only 20% penetration pre-crisis, right? All those people who are reluctant, probably our in-laws and whatnot, are now going to embrace e-com delivery, right? That's an opportunity for our strong brands to really lean in and take advantage of lower customer acquisition costs and arbitrage all over the place. And so rather than spend less, maybe we should be spending more. And several companies took that attitude. And one case, without calling out their numbers, we had a particular company that found they were doing per week as much on e-com as they were doing in a brick and mortar store a year by the fourth week of this crisis. And that led them to close several of their stores permanently, but maintain their staffing because they now shifted their revenue to e-com. So my point of me saying that is I believe every crisis opens up an aperture to an alternative universe where people are doing exactly what you're doing, but doing it in a different way. And if you just give your permissions to look for that portal, you're going to find that. And I found that across the board. Everyone says, yeah, but not in my case. My business is screwed. You know, I hear what you're saying, but it's not true. It is always true.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I feel like sometimes the greatest barrier that we have to change and improvement in our businesses is ourselves, because we have this expectation that this thing isn't going to work, or this idea isn't going to work, or people aren't going to want to work with us. And so we don't even try it. And what the amazing thing that has happened here as a result of the pandemic is that it has pushed people to try things that they hadn't considered before, to try things that maybe they had considered before but were afraid of. It reminds me, and I just kind of put this anecdote to you to see what you think of it. I recently was talking to this guy named Aziz, who he's a master or whatever, the can't remember the language of it. He's a franchise owner who owns like 700 something units. And he had this idea years ago to solve for the problem of most restaurants that he owns, I think probably most restaurants in general, are rarely at full capacity in their kitchen. This is pre-COVID, right? It's just so many restaurants. And so that, you know, you're losing money because you invested a lot of time, a lot of money into building this thing out, and now you're not using it at full capacity. And these restaurants all operate on the margins anyway. So what would happen if you were able to, say, take one brand's food and just make it at another brand's restaurant and then, you know, sell it online? So for example, the Captain's Boil, which is in Canada, is not operating in America, but what if it actually could be because it's just being sold out of a Ruby Tuesdays and you order it on Seamless? And he said years ago, he just started building this for his own units. And then when COVID came along, he opened it up and he invited other brands to utilize the platform. And they flooded in with requests. I mean, he is struggling. The platform is called Franklin Junction. Somebody's shouting it out right there. NRD Capital, right, James. Right, it's called Franklin Junction. Thank you. It's, you know what's weird about doing these sessions online now instead of doing...
I can't see what you see now. I want to see your...
pop up and then you have to take other information instead of just dealing with whatever limited amount of information you have in your own head. So thank you, Brain Trust. So anyway, but here's the thing that I really loved about this, and the reason I'm telling you about him is because I asked him pre-COVID, would other brands, does he think, would they have been as interested and as eager to work with Franklin Junction? Because Franklin Junction is really, it's a challenge to the restaurant model as we know it, where you think you build a restaurant, you sell your food. Now we're all suddenly in like a mix and match world, and that could be very threatening to a certain subset of people. And I said, do you think that adoption of Franklin Junction has happened a lot faster because of COVID? And he said, absolutely, absolutely, because it has forced people to be open-minded to solutions that they may not have considered before, even though they would have been valuable to them before, but they wouldn't have considered it as an option before. And now they do. So I put that to you. Is that something that you're seeing where there's just a more rapid adoption of change, more open-mindedness to think about things in new ways, to, in fact, do things that might have previously challenged the very notion of what we have, what our business is, what our industry is, but now it feels like, let's try it.
Well, that's a great example, an example that I am familiar with just from being in the food space. To extend it, you know, cloud kitchens, right? Travis and a bunch of others were attempting really sort of take this concept, bring it to scale. For those who don't know, aggregating small kitchen spaces and enabling brands to go delivery only, right? Because if you're doing a restaurant or, you know, fast casual unit, maybe you're spending $750,000 a build out to get that going, and you're trying to get it to a place where your margins are 20%. And you want to get your build out, recover it in 2 to 3 years. That's sort of been the model, right? Very hard to make that work. You know, cloud kitchen, you could stand one up for, say, $75,000. Your rent is a lot lower and you're doing delivery only. There was this general sort of resistance to it. Is that actually undermining the food industry? There's a lot of purists who thought it's not really the direction we want to go in. You know, fast forward, post COVID, complete adoption. Every type of brand is looking for a way to go ahead and reduce, you know, their investment, you know, in CapEx, but also how to take advantage of what had been sitting there prior to. And that's one thing that gets me very excited. I mean, I think we have a fundamental obligation to be optimistic, right? And to fight back. There was, in the early days of COVID, there was a little bit of shaming, like we're not supposed to talk about business or selling. I say that's nonsense, right? Like, let's get back on our feet. Let's be positive. Let's fight. Let's be aggressive. And so, and one of the ways to do that is to look for opportunities to go ahead and figure out what has changed. And a couple of things that I see that get me really excited. Prior to COVID, if you were launching a business, you were a startup, at a minimum, you needed to have a WeWork to at least be respectable to whatever VC like me that you're talking to. Like, where are you located? Where's the team? Two, you needed to some extent an articulated brand. You needed a team. The team probably at least had to have a nucleus in one location. You needed to come visit me, get on a plane, spend your money on airplane tickets, and then go out to Silicon Valley, and then somebody cancels the meeting just as you're landing. I mean, all that friction, right? Fast forward 3 months later, you wake up in your pajamas, you know, you go ahead and you put a nice shirt on, you know, like right now I have my shorts on, can't see though. Everything has changed. You go ahead and you're talking to a VC on the other side of the country, and he's got extra time because he's no longer commuting and she's no longer commuting, and they can go and talk to you. So the bar's been lower, and you can have a virtual team that you've assembled through Slack and other means that you maybe have never even met. And you can get out there with your idea, right? When we get through this, when we finally get our act together and government figures out, you know, a way forward, the amount of innovation that's going to be ushered in by this year is extraordinary. And the amount of friction that has permanently been removed from that innovation cycle is incredible. I don't know what it's going to take to get me back on a plane again to do a business meeting, but it's going to be a lot harder, which means that I can conduct my business via Zoom and whatnot and close deals a lot faster. It means I could take pitches all day from folks. So that goes back to my point. I am 100% positive that a portal has been opened up right now, and it's incumbent upon every one of us who's struggling in their own particular business to find it. My biggest frustrations, I just had this a couple hours ago. I was mad at myself. Like, why can't I see the opportunity? Like, I know there's an opportunity for this particular business and I haven't found it yet. I need to do more work because I know it's there. And I'm anxious that I'm missing it. I'm not anxious that the business has only about 4 months of cash runway. I'm anxious that my brain hasn't been clever enough to figure out where the opening is. Oh, so call me. That's my outlook, and I'm not going to change it.
No, I love you sharing that anxiety. That's my primary anxiety too. Every single day, I feel like there's massive opportunities out there, and I don't know if I'm able. I don't know if I'm stepping up to it. I don't know if I'm stepping up in the right way, and I don't know if I have the right time, and I don't have the right ideas. And I feel that that's great. That's a great position to be in. I want to go back to something that you just said a second ago, though, because it was interesting. You were describing an old world, a calcified world, right? A world that, you know, you're excited to move away from. But you inserted yourself into that world. You were the VC that people have to fly to see. You probably had certain expectations about how you would meet people, what you would hear from. So talk to me about how your own position in that world has changed. How have you seen change in yourself? How have you seen your own expectations change? And then what are you challenging yourself to do to look at things in new ways? So, you know, the things that used to be just a standard, unquestioned part of your vetting process or your working with people has changed now, which is probably, you've probably run into a number of those things where you thought it was important and then you said, wait a second. No, it's actually not important. And you have to revise your own understanding and expectations. Take me through that process.
That's a great question. So let me just only speak from my own personal experience. Like, whether we like it or not, we all belong to a system. It's akin to, we say, well, advertising doesn't affect me, but it does affect you, whether you think it or not. You walk by a billboard, it affects you, or else people wouldn't get paid to do it. So the system was acting upon us in all sorts of ways that were invisible. So what did the system mean? The system had a premium on FaceTime, on meeting face-to-face. It had a premium on sort of showing up and being in an office. You had people of a particular age, including myself, I'm in my 40s, right, who tended to be very resistant to working from home. Oh, those youngins aren't going to do anything if they're home. They're just going to want Netflix. Like, all these sort of built-in biases that, like, you needed to see each other face-to-face to look you in the eye to make sure, you know, before you do a deal and teams needed to be in one place because they can't communicate. There are a lot of these assumptions that the system was imposing upon all of us collectively, driven by the decision makers. So I'll just leave that statement there for a second. I was one of them, right? Now I was forced to adapt. Now I'm working from my third floor and suddenly conducting business and forced to adopt technological tools that I may have shunned. And by the way, I no longer am commuting. So I'm noticing I'm actually working 3 hours more a day because I'm not commuting. And so I'm infinitely more productive, number one. Two, it turns out that all my work is more accretive because it's being more self-driven. I'm not playing defense. I'm not answering emails as much or dealing with people walking in my office. I'm deciding about impact. So the work that I choose to do every day is infinitely more impactful because I'm being intentional about it. Three, I'm around my kids more. I feel better. I'm not like yearning to see my children as much, which turned out was breaking my heart. So I'm spending all this time. And four, I'm not traveling once or twice a week and then needing the recovery from the travel, but yet I'm doing the same work that I used to do before. In fact, it's easier to get CEOs on the phone. And five, they're having the same emotions that I'm having, which means that the system now has been redefined because the people who are vested in maintaining it before have changed their view toward it. So now all of us can forecast if that means that the people who were resistant to these changes, technological adaptation, working from home, forcing in-face meetings, FaceTime and whatnot, those people have all changed their minds collectively. That means the entire world has sort of changed. So that's what gets me excited, because now I can look outside myself and think about, look at all the pointless friction that we imposed upon the system just because we just were not aware. And then out of all the things that I can predict, I'm 100% true that I'm sure that is true. And it'll all be disguised, by the way, under the guise of, well, we can save more money by having smaller real estate footprints if we sort of rotate people in and out. It'll masquerade as a financial decision, but in reality, it's a quality of life and efficiency decision that'll change how we all behave. I know that's a lot to unpack. I just went very cerebral on you, but I feel really passionate.
I mean, listen, my follow-up question is going to get philosophical. So
okay, let's go. Let's do it. We're going deep.
Oh, you don't even know how deep. You don't even know. We have to take one more short break. And when we come back, we will finish the conversation with Matt Higgins, where I get philosophical. I want to take what Matt just said about learning from these moments and creating change and seeing how we can harness that and make ourselves more resilient to change going forward. Because, of course, this is not the only moment of change that we will all experience. It's a big one, but it's not the only one. So what do we do next time? First, a break. Problem Solvers is brought to you by JustWorks. JustWorks is here to support the small business superheroes working hard to protect their companies and take care of their teams. With simple software and expert support for payroll, benefits, compliance, and HR, JustWorks takes some of the guesswork out of running a business in good times and bad. They know that small business leaders wear many hats, and they're here to help you do it all. With JustWorks, you get seamless tools for managing remote teams and navigating new legislation. This includes scheduling, tracking, and staying compliant with new leave requirements from day one. JustWorks' dedicated team of certified HR consultants can help you navigate the ins and outs of managing remote teams in these challenging times. And should you or your team ever have any questions about your benefits or payroll, you can just call JustWorks anytime. Really, anytime. 11 p.m. on a Sunday, round-the-clock support is standing by. JustWorks is here for those who do it all. Learn more at justworks.com/problem solvers. Again, that is justworks.com/problem solvers. All right, we're back, and it is time to get back into the conversation with Matt. By the way, I can't help but saying, maybe you don't care, but because I am so obsessed with audio, I am sorry that my audio sounds like garbage during this interview. The microphone that I usually use on podcasts, for some reason, I had a problem with it. It wasn't working when I was trying to connect with Matt, so I had to just talk into my computer. And so that's why I sound quite different right now from what you hear in the conversation. But I hope you tolerate it, because it is such a great conversation. Okay, here it is. Now we go deep.
You just described this revelation that you and others had that a lot more, in fact, could get accomplished and you could be happier at the same time if you didn't go to the office. But the thing is that for people who research this stuff, that was not news at all. We have had research for a long time showing that remote workers are happier, they're more efficient, they stick around in their companies longer. So this is something that we knew, and yet we never actually acted upon because we didn't trust the information. We, of course, only trust our own experiences. So now we've been forced into it. We have now experienced it, and thus we have changed. So here's my philosophical question. How much further can we go with this? How do you think we can take this one learning moment, which is to say, oh, this thing that we feared, this change that we feared, actually, this change was good and we shouldn't have feared it. And then apply that to future things where we say, oh, this other thing that I now fear, maybe I'm not going to get shoved into it the way that I did in 2020 because of a pandemic, but maybe it's worth me reconsidering my own concerns and resistance to fear and then actually being okay with this. Or this is something that I'm obsessed with, cycles of fear and why we, you know, feared the novel in the same way that we then feared the radio, that we now fear video games. Over and over again, we very rarely are able to learn from it. The researcher Amy Orban calls it the Sisyphean cycle of tech panic, which is brilliant. So how do we break that? And do you think that there's some something that you can do within yourself and then maybe that you can also share with entrepreneurs that you work with to say, you know what, the next time that you face something where you say, oh, this is change that we can't actually adopt, this is a system that isn't going to work for us, we can say, you know what, we can learn from this past experience that we just had in which we discovered that our assumptions were actually totally wrong, and we can apply it to this new moment right now and say, oh, maybe our assumptions now are wrong too, and then we can move forward better. So there's my philosophical question.
Oh, that's like a really, now you went even deeper than I would follow. Well, I'm gonna answer that in two steps. First, let's talk specifically about the holding on to the insights that we've all gleaned collectively and making sure we don't regress and lose the opportunity to innovate. I think that officialdom and the decision makers are going to put their energy into mitigating the downsides so that we can hold on to the gains, because there are downsides. I think that younger employees lose out a bit if they don't have some of that actual face time. So they don't have an ability to go ahead and get the mentorship. That's one thing I sort of need. So two, we do need people to convene collectively at important moments to reinforce connections, intimacy, information sharing. So office environments need to be structured in a way where they allow at some regular rhythm where everybody comes together. I don't know if that's a every other week type thing, but the idea that you're going to have a remote workforce that's never going to see each other again, and maybe you'll have a happy hour every 3 months, like, to me doesn't work. So I think we need to put some energy into how we structure real estate to enable you to have the smaller footprint, rotating office, a staff spread out, but enable everyone to come together in some kind of rhythm. So I'm looking at more readings around best practices. What might that look like? So number one, I think we're going to look to hold on to the gains. So let's talk about fear. I am perhaps less optimistic that this is going to be a catalyst to break that cycle that we tend to resist innovation, because I think it's somewhat human nature. I think about this topic a lot. I was at 9/11. I was the mayor's press secretary at the time. I had a whole nother life. And then I was the first employee of the rebuilding of the World Trade Center. So I was there the day of the attacks, the moment the attacks happened. And then I spent 2 years of my life helping to manage the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site. And I got to see everything on display, pain, grief, the emotions, the sense that we need to rebuild this now, but we need to rebuild this exactly the same as it was, and we need to rebuild it different, you know, all those competing interests. And what I found looking at that over the course of several years is that all the predictions around fear, we're never going to be comfortable in a tall building again, we're never going to want to be in crowded workspaces for fear of a suicide bomber, we as humans tend to leave fear behind, and we retain the innovations that matter, that protect us or make us better. Airplane security. We haven't had another incident of that magnitude since. And so I think similar to COVID, we're going to leave the fear behind. We are going to reconvene in restaurants and crowded events again when we get the all clear. And we're going to go ahead and we're going to retain the innovations and the efficiencies, the things that made us better. But I'm not sure that this is going to collectively break the cycle of self-awareness to say, hey, next time something's in our face, we should be less resistant and we should look to embrace it, because the resistance comes from within. I talk about this a lot. The resistance itself to innovation comes from the need for security and stability and to have some permanency. We all kind of crave that. We're not comfortable. We need to be told that we're safe. I work on trying to become a more open-minded by meditating on one simple thought all the time. It's okay, and I'm okay. And I learned that from having gone through cancer. You know, I had testicular cancer when I was 32 years old. And one of the things I found that was most fascinating is once I knew I wasn't dying during that period, to some extent, I was relieved of caring about all the little nonsensical things that we care about all the day that do not hold up juxtaposed against imminent death. A lot of our minds are cluttered with stuff that's just nonsense. And so I adopted into my life, and now manifests in the form of an app, because there's an app for everything, of course, called WeCroak, where I remind myself several times a day that I'm going to die, whispering in my ear. And that relieves me of, don't be afraid, don't care. Everything's okay. You can experiment, be open-minded. That worked for me personally. It'll probably work for you personally too. But do I think this collectively is going to make us more open-minded? I don't think so.
Well, I didn't expect fundamental change to human behavior out of this moment. I mean, if that was the case, then we would have fixed this problem after the bubonic plague, which gave us our modern economy as we know it, but of course didn't eliminate resistance to fear. But what I was wondering, and I think you at least partially answered it there with that really great reminder, it's okay, you're okay, is what is your suggestion to entrepreneurs for how the next time they face something where they feel like this is a change too far, that they can maybe tap into the experience that we've had or shift their perspective and somehow be able to see past the barrier and onto the opportunity?
Yeah, and I think I say this a lot. I really believe it. It's borrowed from Churchill and updated for today. You know, to persist truly is to prevail. Right? The mere act of persisting yet another day, and then another day on top of that, and now you've strung together 7 days, the mere act of persistence and the belief and the desire to persist, you will ultimately prevail. So when I talk to entrepreneurs, it's like, you have to have faith that you are going to iterate to a place, to a better place. And the thing you need to work most on is the open-mindedness and the receptivity to that simple belief, right? That if I keep going and I move forward, I will get there. That doesn't mean you don't pivot and iterate, right? So how do you become a successful person at iterating along the way? I think the number one thing that we all need to always work on is self-awareness. Self-awareness is the single greatest form of arbitrage in business and in your personal life that is entirely within your control. You don't need to take a course. You don't need to listen to a podcast. You just need to decide that I'm going to become self-aware. And the only way to do it is to work on the things that are blocking you from being self-aware. I think a lot of the energy I spend when I'm diligencing a deal, I bring in an industrial psychologist who's worked on me when I was younger. She knows me. She understands what to look for. I start there, or at least I end there, because I want to identify the things that are causing all of us to be stuck, because those things will impede our ability to be self-aware. And if you're not self-aware, you will not iterate along the way in the founder journey. So it's a long way of saying, what's my advice is like anything that's forming, that's getting in the way of you being comfortable, being self-aware and identifying where things aren't going right, then we'll work on those things. And if we work on those things, you'll achieve your full potential and your business's full potential.
It's okay. A reminder of death. I don't know if you know this, just a fun fact. I don't know. Fun fact feels weird on this, but this comes from an older episode that I did. And I just looked it up because I wanted to find the right language. So in ancient Roman times, if a general won a great battle, they were given a parade. And while they were paraded through the streets, they had a slave who sat behind the general, constantly whispering these lines: "Remember, thou art human and not divine," over and over again. Remember, thou art human and not divine, because of course you want to remember that bad things can happen to you, that you are not divine, you are not, you can't expect everything to go your way. And instead, you have to be reminded, even in great times, even when you are succeeding, that you're part of a larger system and you can't control it. So,
I'm fascinated by this topic because forgive me if it was Plato or Socrates, but talks about, you know, death and mortality. Like, imagine if the one thing we were most afraid of turned out to be the best thing. But you don't need to go that far to embrace the following, which is, I don't think we spend enough time talking about our mortality because it's like the dirty little secret and we feel like it's going to be too heavy. And what I learned from having cancer, it wasn't that it was heavy. It actually just reminded you about how you spend a lot of time worrying about things that aren't going to matter. And if you could unclutter your mind, you can live a life of less fear. Like, you can play with the house's money because you've already factored in the thing that you were most afraid of before, and turns out you're not afraid of it anymore. So I think that going back to, you know, ancient Greece and whatnot, I think the part of that point was to remind you, you are immortal, it will end, you're a human, and also don't believe your own headlines, general, whatever you just conquered. So I try to stay close to those ideas.
Do you think that crisis of any kind can help people put this in perspective? I wonder if we come out of this all with some more of that self-awareness and an understanding of what matters, what our priority is, and also a clarity of vision about what our value is to others.
I think it definitely does. I'm a big believer in the growth that comes out of crisis, just because I've seen the cycle play out in my life over and over again. But when life brings you to your knees, it forces you to really meditate on what matters to you. And I get asked this question a lot, like, what's the secret for your success? Or you've done multiple things in different industries and gone to the top. And I say, I think the number one thing is, the higher I go, the more I work at defining what I absolutely need as narrowly as possible. It's interesting, like, because part of the things that holds you back of taking increasing risk is you're now nervous. You want to consolidate the gains and you don't want to lose them, right? Theoretically, you've accumulated more in your life. You're more prominent. You're more wealthy. You have more things to lose. And that actually makes you play in a risk-averse way. I've tried to do the inverse. The higher I go, the more I meditate. Like, I got my wife. I have the best wife in the world, Sarah. She's incredible. She's my, you know, partner in everything I do. I have my kids. I have my house. If it all goes tomorrow, I don't really care. And I kind of learned that from cancer, because I called it zero time. When I had cancer, I thought, wow, interesting. I'm really relieved because I don't really worry about stuff anymore to the same extent. So I would argue to folks coming out of this crisis, think about how we've all been brought to our knees. And we've revealed how it's the simplest things that we miss the most, right? We miss going to a restaurant. We miss a lot. We don't miss a lot of the things that didn't really matter. And so I think absolutely is a chance that it sounds like everyone collectively across civilization, which is refreshing, is taking advantage of this crisis to ask the same existential question. So I think we'll never be able to measure this, but you ask a great question. I think there'll be enormous personal advancements made emotionally, spiritually, and then of course, ultimately show up in business, but that we all have made through this period. I don't know how you measure it, but I'm pretty sure it's probably true because everyone right now who's listening to this is nodding like, yeah, I've made a lot of growth personally.
Yeah, I think that that's a great way to look at it. And we need that reminder, I feel like sometimes because, you know, the craziest thing that I have found in talking to entrepreneurs as I do, and I actually just wrote about this in the magazine, is that in talking to so many entrepreneurs, what I see is the great collective irony that everybody experiences these same challenges and, you know, crisis or not, right? I mean, if you want to look at it in one way, the pandemic is just a larger version of what entrepreneurs experience all the time, which is just some kind of constant crisis, something that comes out of nowhere that seems to challenge the very fundamentals of the work that we've done. And then we have to adapt to it. And this is just a larger version, one in which it's happening to everybody at the same time. But the weird thing is that most people experience these things alone and they feel like they are personal challenges that they're only dealing with alone. And if they don't communicate that, then what they never learn is that in fact, they are actually quite alone together because everybody is experiencing roughly the same problems, maybe at different times, but that's what they're doing. And so I want to put it to you because one thing that you have, one of the many things you're so great at is being open and communicative about those things. I mean, I listened to past interviews that you've done and you touch on these themes a lot. And I feel like in doing so, I hope, and maybe this is in your mind, you're inspiring other people to share their own concerns and to be open as well about these things. I wonder how you came to that kind of openness, if you always had it, and what you feel like people should be doing when they are facing these kinds of things and they feel like they're alone with them.
Wow, those are great questions. You know, I was going to quote you actually, now you just did it, but you had a great line where you said, the entrepreneurial journey is about being alone together, right? And we're all out there going through exactly the same emotional state. I think for me, for a long time, I didn't really talk too much about my origin story. One, I just thought, who cares? And then as my platform has grown, I decided that was very motivating to me, right? Like I'm not motivated by fame or prominence so that I could walk down the street like Gary. Like I walk with him, I'm like, wow, that seems like exhausting. We can't go 2 feet without you being recognized. So that's not intrinsically motivating to me. What is motivating to me is that if I share my vulnerability to a 17-year-old kid who's hopeless, who's in a GED program in Queens, and I tell my origin story, they're going to have belief. And I started realizing more and more that the value that I think I could bring to civilization or a few people is to be really vulnerable and transparent about my origin story so that you don't conclude when you look at me, there's a white male, probably went to Harvard, probably had good upbringing, lots of money, that I'm actually doing a disservice. I'm actually contributing to the alienation that a lot of people have out there of saying, I can't go this far. This is not for, it's out of reach. So I decided I'm going to share it in a way that's like raw and ugly. It feels good. I like telling a story about the fact that I dropped out of high school when I was 16. I did it on purpose. I got left back 2 years in a row. I was taking care of my mother who couldn't even bathe herself. And she was slowly dying in the room next door to me. I spent 10 years of my life with a towel wrapped around my head so I couldn't hear her screaming all night long. Like I went through trauma and hell and it didn't end well. She died the day I became press secretary of New York City. I went from making $375 at McDonald's to being the press secretary of the mayor of New York, youngest one in history, finally achieved everything, and she died that day. And I tell the story because, one, there are no guaranteed happy endings. Two, we have to be agents of our own rescue. There's no cavalry coming. But three, you can do it. Like, you can pull it off. It's going to be ugly and unfair. You wish you were born into different circumstances, whatever. You can do it. And not only that, your prize when you get there, what you went through will be so compelling how far you've come that that'll be your reward. In fact, I sometimes feel bad because I always want to be clear. I'm not judging anybody who didn't have tough circumstances. I don't think people should have to manufacture, like, I went through something really bad. If you didn't really go through anything that bad, like, high five. I wish I had gone through that too. And I'm not going to judge you because life is not about where you begin. It's where you end up, right? So if you started on third base, good. I hope you own the stadium by the end of it. For me, I wasn't even at the stadium, right? Like, so that's a terrible metaphor. But my point is, I like sharing it. Like, I don't know, I've been through enough now to realize that not much really matters in this world, right? Like not, I think we're all gonna end up in the same place. We're all struggling with mortality. We're trying to figure out why am I here and where am I going? So if I could sort of share my story and help people feel a little bit hopeful that if he could do it coming from dirt, then I could do it too. That makes me feel great. So although, because I think people would, if I didn't share my story, they would draw the wrong conclusions about where I came from. And I'd be contributing to the problem. That's a very convoluted abstract statement, but that's what motivates me.
So that reminds me of an experience I had once. I was talking to a group of college students at some event, whatever it was. And I honestly don't remember what it was that I said, but I also have the philosophy of sharing the bad stuff, sharing the vulnerability, because I think that that's what makes you human. And that's also what people want to see. People don't like success stories. They like problem-solving stories. They like journey stories. So I did. I said whatever it is that I said. And afterwards, this girl comes up to me and she says, I just really wanted to thank you for being so vulnerable and taking those risks of doing so in front of us. And I said to her, you're welcome. But there was no risk there because I know that you like that. I know that you want that. I know that people really like vulnerability. And in fact, I would tell you that if you go out and you are vulnerable too, then somebody's going to come up to you and thank you for doing it. There is, in fact, once you start doing it and you discover the value in it, you discover there's really no risk at all. In fact, it's all giving and it's all giving people what they want, which is a weird way to think of it. But I say all that as a way to put to you as we, I think we have 45 minutes, right? So we're sort of coming to the end. To go into podcasting, as everyone is doing, you share your story. You share your story quite a lot on podcasts. I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle to share their personal story. They're afraid of opening up in that way. They're afraid of maybe putting, I don't know exactly what they're afraid of, putting a target on their back, feeling very uncomfortable, not sure if what they're sharing is an appropriate way to share it. I wonder how you came to understand how to tell your story. Did you talk to people? One thing that I have done is I've honed stories of my own that I share more broadly is that I started by just realizing the way that I would tell a story to friends and the beats that really worked as I was telling those stories to friends. And then I could just port that over once I felt really comfortable with it and understood how to tell it in a way that felt compelling and also true. And then you could do it on stage. I wonder just what was your own journey in as somebody who was afraid to tell your story and then eventually discovered the power of your story of how you've done that and how other entrepreneurs might be able to open themselves up more too.
First of all, I love what a deep thinker you are. Can we just sit just how these questions are so wonderful and philosophical? Yeah, because it's something but you make a really good point. Like, you want to be sure that you're not being manipulative either by sharing, because it does create a feedback loop. People do respond to vulnerability. And so you want to make sure you're doing it for pure reasons and you're also doing it authentically. So I would just put that warning there, because I'm always auditing myself. Like, I don't want to be manipulative just because I know people respond to it. I want to do it for the right reasons. So how did I come to it? It was a revelation about leadership more than anything else. When I had cancer when I was 32, I was devastated, not because I might die or lose a piece of my anatomy that is rather intimate and embarrassing at the time, but like that I went back to work within 24 hours of coming home with a kind of big incision on my side, sitting with a bunch of coaches at the New York Jets, because I wanted to demonstrate nothing's going to knock me down, because I was afraid. I was afraid of losing my job, my contract. I felt like nobody cares. So I spent the first 35 years of my life, 38 years of my life, living one, a life of shame when I was a kid, hiding my poverty, trying to hide my cancer, trying to hide any vulnerability because I wanted to be that guy. And actually, what brought me to my knees was divorce and realizing how traumatic that really is to go through loss of your self-identity, loss of your children, custody schedule, all these issues, and how tremendously unforgiving I had been of other people who had gone through it. I used to think, like, whatever, okay, I hear it, but like, time to get back to work. And then I started thinking, I've really actually been unforgiving with people just generally because I wanted to be that guy. And what I realized is, if you are not forgiving of yourself and allow yourself to be vulnerable and give yourself a moment to be human, you are going to be a terrible leader, because you're not going to extend that to others. You do not extend to others what you deny to yourself. And so I started realizing, like, I actually felt a lot of remorse about all the different times people were going through something that just wasn't very humane. Not that I was mean, I just didn't connect. And so, unfortunately, I'd like there to be a different moral of the story. It took for me to being brought to my knees more than anything else for me to go through that evolution. But to the podcasters out there and to everyone else and entrepreneurs, you don't need to go through that journey. Just understand that whatever you are doing in life, authenticity will make you more successful, because the thing that you fear to be revealed, it'll turn out that it wasn't really a big deal. I don't care what you went through. Like, there is no shame in this universe. And in fact, the key to probably unlocking your true greatness and your potential is to be authentic. So just trust in that one little statement. Don't just say, Matt told me to do it, share everything and everything will be all right.
I think that's great advice. I'll add a bit of my own for whatever it's worth. something that I found really useful is to always remind myself, and this is a little bit like, remember thou art human and not divine, is to always remind myself that nobody cares about me. They care about themselves, as they should, because they are the ones that they are living with, and they're the thing that they're building. They're their greatest project, not me. Who cares about me? So if somebody's listening to me now as we talk, or on a podcast or on stage or whatever, they don't care about me. They care about them. They care about what it is that I offer them. So once you understand that, you can think, well, I can if I'm sharing something in a way in which I think that it's going to be valuable to them, well, then it's useful and it's good and it's worth sharing. And if it's not valuable to them, then why am I talking about it anyway? Because this isn't really about me. And if you remember that, then, I mean, this is how we make the magazine as well. The stories that I tell, even when we're writing about somebody, I never think that it's about somebody. If we profiled you in the magazine, Matt, we'd write about you, but I would not think of it as a story about Matt. I would think about it as a story about the reader, in which Matt has gone through things that he's going to share to the reader. And that's really the purpose of it. So if you frame yourself that way, then everything actually feels quite comfortable to share because you know what the mission is. You know the purpose of it.
There's a great line in Billions. I'm forgetting the character, the DA, right? He needs to save his election. So he decides to share all their, inclinations and sexual proclivities. And the wife is horrified because he doesn't go ahead and consult her on it, right? And they're having a dinner. And at dinner, she's still grieving the fact, this loss of every time she's going to have a new encounter with anybody, they're immediately going to think you're the deviant or whatever. And she's told at dinner, she's like, they will, for about 3 seconds. And then they're going to turn to themselves because people are fundamentally caught up with their greatest project, which is themselves. So the advice you gave, it's a good little scene, but to pull a broader point, people are not devoting the amount of energy. When I talk to college students, the number one thing I tell them is what you actually just said. I said, you want to hear what's going to be really horrifying that you're going to find out later in life that's going to really trouble you? Nobody cared. You're going to be like, oh, wait, nobody cared. I cared so much that they would care. And it turns out they only cared about themselves. And I spent all this energy that I could have been using for some other things or just allowing myself to be myself. So nobody cares and nobody will care in the end. So let it all go.
Nobody cares about me. Nobody cares about Matt Higgins. But I hope that my conversation with Matt Higgins gave you something to care about for yourself, which of course is the point. Anyway, thank you so much to Matt Higgins. Thanks to Podmax. Thanks to you. I really enjoyed this and I hope you did too.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeiffer.com, JasonFeiffer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.